We're going to save the country, or maybe destroy it. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, Barry, how are you?
Well, you know, I'm doing pretty well.
Glad to hear it. I'm doing pretty well. Sunday night, it's a nice night out. And while it's a nice night out, what am I doing? I'm sitting inside recording radio.
That's right. That's because we love our audience and we want to give them the best and the freshest that we possibly can do without actually having to trudge down to Rushville and sit in studio to have a live program.
Well, that's right.
No, but we love the guys at WLRY. Mike O'Reilly's been a great contact, great person to work with. We have really been enjoying this. Chuck, I can't believe that we've actually been on the air now because we're going into May. We've been on the air 7 months. Now, I know that probably seems like forever to some of our listeners and probably seems like not that much time to those who are just tuning in.
It really seems like forever to those people who hate our show.
Well, that's okay. And you know, honestly, if they hate our show, as long as they spell our names right and comment on what we're saying so that others go and look us up or tune us in, then I'm all happy about that.
That's right. There's no such thing as bad publicity.
No bad publicity. That's right.
Okay. Well, that's great. And we should be getting plenty of it.
Yeah, well, we should. And, you know, we say some things on this program that I'm sure that not all of our audience agrees with at any one time. And as a matter of fact, there's sometimes when we'll go over things and then a little bit later we'll go over sort of the antithesis, Chuck. And I think today's one of those programs. We're kind of looking at something we've talked about in the past, and that is whether or not it's reasonable or viable to be involved or to support a non-major party in this country. As you know, most people think we have a two-party system, that the Republicans and the Democrats are basically all there is because they're the big boys on the block. But we've had other upstarts, and for purposes of full disclosure, Chuck, you and I have been part of some of those upstarts, including the Constitution Party. We've also got the Libertarian Party. As a matter of fact, I believe that maybe not every one of them carries ballot access at any one time, but I think over the course of the last few decades, there's probably been 20 or 30 different political parties that have registered just in the state of Ohio alone on the ballot for everything from the President of the United States down to township trustees, and I think down to in a negative sense, it runs the gamut from federal to local. People who have, for some reason or other, they don't agree with the platforms of the two major parties. They don't agree with the candidates that the parties put forth. They don't agree with the policies that the two parties are pushing when they get control in some of these offices. They choose to go another route. They choose to go what we call the third party route. And Chuck, honestly, it would be the third to do the 33rd, I think, in as many parties as we have in this country.
Well, right now, there are approximately 29 billion third parties, I think, something like that. I'm being facetious, but there are a lot of them out there.
Well, people have everything to choose from the Christian Liberty Party all the way over to the Communist Party USA.
Well, that's right. Green Party. The third parties cover the gamut of the political spectrum, so they're all over the place. I honestly think that probably most third parties are either conservative or libertarian type, but there are, again, as you said, the Communist Party, the Green Party.
Natural Law Party, the Transcendentalist Party. The beat goes on, Jack.
Yeah, exactly. And for most part, what you'll find is that people involved are either very principle-minded. In other words, they are objecting to the principles represented by the two major parties, or there are really just fringe thinkers, quote-unquote fringe, who are interested in being together with people who agree with them in their possibly more extreme views, and they want to band together and see if they can make some political hay.
Well, that latter wouldn't describe us, Chuck. I believe we kind of fall in that former camp, right?
We'd like to think so.
But maybe by thinking so, that automatically puts us in the latter camp. I'm not sure.
Well, as you'll notice, as we've mentioned before, you and I have sort of abandoned the idea of the third party.
And that doesn't mean that we've radically embraced one of the two major parties in doing that. Well, I think we've become more independent and introspective when it comes to this whole political mess.
I'm going to go far afield from what we planned to talk about just for a second.
Sure, fire away.
This year, of course, I'm teaching a class at Camp American called the Electoral College, Original Intent, How It's Broken, and Why It Still Works. And I'm going to teach kids there this year on this, as I've taught before, that the original system there were no parties. You will hear these stories about how America has always been a two-party system. Well, when America started, it was a no-party system.
That's entirely right. And as a matter of fact, Chuck, I'm glad you brought this up, because right now in our Institute on the Constitution class, one of the documents that we have students read, and my students are finishing up so we can discuss tomorrow night, or tonight, I guess, as this broadcasts on Monday, is Washington's farewell address, where one of the things that he points out as the one thing that can wreck this system of government that the founders gave us was what he called the spirit of faction, which, if you understand the vernacular from the late 18th century, meant party system, breaking down into political party camps and deciding everything based upon party.
And I believe he actually used the term party.
Yeah, well, he said the spirit of faction to start with, but then he also talked about the party spirit, yes.
And this is exactly what he was talking about. Washington should have known very well what was going on, because what we call the two major parties are both outgrowths of George Washington's cabinet.
That's correct.
There were two parties there. There were the Federalists, who were the same people who were the Federalists at the, more or less the same people. There were some people who jumped ship, but let's just keep it simple, stupid. The quote-unquote Federalists at the Constitutional Convention. And then there was a group that rallied behind Thomas Jefferson called the Democrat Republicans, and at the time, they were mostly called the Republicans.
That's right.
Now, this is where it gets confusing, Barry.
Need to have a flow chart or a scorecard in order to keep track of who's who in this.
I'll walk everybody through what happened. The Federalists became the Whigs.
Exactly.
And the Whigs became the modern day
Republican Party, yes.
Okay, the Republicans became the Democrats.
Exactly.
Just to keep things very interesting.
And then if we just look at philosophy from about the 1940s, 1950s on, the Democrats voted historically like conservative Republicans now, and the Republicans voted like liberal Democrats.
These parties switched position after the election of 1912.
Yeah, we call that the Great Realignment.
The Great Realignment. Believe me, 1912 was an election to sit home for. There, talk about major parties. There were four parties.
That's right. That's right.
Four, I'm sure there were other minors, but there were four parties vying for control in 1912. A lot of people don't know this. There were the Republicans.
Correct.
The Democrats.
Absolutely. The Bull Moose Party.
Bull Moose Party and Eugene V. Debs and the Socialist Party. Here's what's interesting about that party. Woodrow Wilson of the Democrats was what we would today consider the conservative.
Exactly.
And if you talk to anybody now who really doesn't like progressivism, they will tell you the horrors of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was a terrible president, but the guys he was running against, Taft and Teddy Roosevelt, Taft with the Republicans and Teddy Roosevelt with the Bull Moose Party, Teddy Roosevelt was challenged, because he was a third party, was challenged to a debate by Eugene V. Debs, who was a socialist. And Teddy Roosevelt steadfastly refused to debate Eugene Debs, and Debs laughed about it and said, of course he refuses to debate me. He's running on my platform.
Exactly.
And he was. There was not a nickel's worth of difference between the Bull Moose platform and the socialist platform.
And we apologize to anybody out there who venerates Teddy Roosevelt, but please study your history. We have.
Because until 1920, really, the election of 1920, the Republican Party was the progressive party. It was in 1920, after World War I and after the debacle of Wilson, that Warren Harding came in and the Republican Party became the conservative party. But until that point, they had been the most liberal party. You have to remember that Woodrow Wilson won by hearkening back to the memory of Grover Cleveland. He was the last true Democrat. He was the last Jeffersonian, because after Grover Cleveland came the candidacies of William Jennings Bryan.
Yes, and the Cross of Gold, yes.
And the Cross of Gold, the floating value of silver, the free silver thing, which is really way too complex to go into. But let's put it this way. People wanted to be able to inflate the currency. It was all about inflating the currency, something that Grover Cleveland had fought tooth and toenail. And Grover Cleveland was a small government Democrat, and he was the last one.
Now, you had said we're kind of traveling far afield from the topic we're going to talk about tonight, but honestly, we're right smack in the middle of it with this discussion.
And this is background that people really need to know to understand sort of what we're going to be getting at. And I'll be quite honest, we're going to run out of time before we even get started on this, but let's keep going until we are out of time.
Right. What we're going to be talking about, obviously not just today, but probably in tomorrow's episode as well, is an article that was in the American Thinker website on April the 29th by a gentleman by the name of Darren Genescu, who I believe is Canadian. And he was writing an interesting piece that both Chuck and I have read and pondered for a little bit. Basically, and it's titled Conservative Third-Party Dreams and Realities. It's a history lesson, and Chuck, it's one that I don't know that either one of us really had a lot of background on, but I think that it raises some interesting thoughts and questions in relation to whether or not those who want to stand on principle should be rushing to embrace a third party and possibly misunderstanding what things a third party will have to do in order to gain ascendancy.
Right.
So that's what we're going to be talking about. But now we're going back through a little background, a little history, and I think our listeners, if they bear with us, we're getting to this point, but we needed to kind of give you a little bit of background.
And that's the problem with these things, Barry. How many people are familiar with the fact that the two-party system is an outgrowth of George Washington's cabinet?
Well, all of our listeners are now, because we've now told them about it.
All they've heard is we've been a two-party system forever. At one point, you know, in the 1820s, we were a one-party system. Here's what's really interesting about that. At one point, the Federalist Party disintegrated.
That's right.
There was no Federalist Party anymore, and that's about around 1818 or so.
Right.
And for the elections of 1820 and 1824, there was one party. For instance, in the election of 1820, there were one party, but there were four candidates from that party.
Which party was it, Chuck?
It was the Democrat Republicans.
The Democrat Republicans, that's right. And oftentimes people focus on the election of 1824 as a watershed.
It is a watershed because what happened there was that Andrew Jackson won the popular vote. But because there were four candidates, nobody won the majority required of the electoral vote. In other words, there was not 50% plus one of the electoral vote that went to any one candidate, so it went to the House of Representatives.
That's right. Well, Chuck, just to help you out, it was called the corrupt bargain.
The corrupt bargain, yes. And my apologies for not remembering. Like, I can't remember the word corrupt, right?
It's not like we see it much today in politics, no.
Two main vote-getters were John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson were the two main electoral vote getters. The other guy was William Crawford, who was the Secretary of State. And then there was Henry Clay.
Henry Clay, who was also Speaker of the House of Representatives at that time.
That's right. Now, the corrupt bargain was said, Andrew Jackson claimed that Henry Clay had made a corrupt bargain with John Quincy Adams.
John Quincy Adams, that's right.
To make certain that John Quincy Adams came out of the House of Representatives as the president.
Now, I think this is interesting, Chuck, because we're going to be going into a Republican Party nominating convention where this type of brokering could be going on even as we speak now over positioning. Because you're right, Jackson and his people believe that Clay made a deal with John Quincy Adams for Clay to become Secretary of State should John Quincy Adams be given the presidency.
Exactly. And this was called the corrupt bargain.
That's right. And guess what? When John Quincy Adams won the vote in the House of Representatives, who became Secretary of State? Henry Clay.
Now, real quick, because we're out of time, what happened then was that Andrew Jackson said, okay, this is never going to happen to me again. Andrew Jackson intended to become President of the United States, period. He had sectional forces in the South and Southeast behind him, and he said, this isn't going to happen again. So he called on his friend from New York, Martin Van Buren, who came up with this plan to organize into what is today called the Modern Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Martin Van Buren is the guy who, along with Andrew Jackson, organized the Modern Democratic Party, and all of a sudden, because of changes in the way the elections were run, they were able to build this popular machine. And so between 1824 and 1828, Van Buren and Jackson organized into this popular juggernaut, essentially, and won the election of 1828, giving John Quincy Adams just one term.
So we've seen where splitting off from the quote-unquote major party can be effective if it's done correctly and if there's a lot of work that's put into it. Now, I guess, Chuck, since we're about running out of time, tomorrow when we come back, we're going to be discussing the article from the American Thinker magazine, Conservative Third-Party Dreams and Realities, in its own particular detail. And having an object lesson from our friends up north.
And join us tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.